It's Wednesday, April 5th, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Republicans prevail in Washington, repealing online privacy laws, which make it possible for internet service providers to sell your search history. We'll talk about the risks for your personal safety and how it might affect our ability to do our jobs as journalists. A radio reporter in Tennessee is suing her former employer for wrongful termination following a story she did on that state's pending bathroom bill. And we're going to talk turkey, or rather, a Chicago station's decision to lead its daily newscast of record with a story about a wild turkey. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with what's going on over at Fox News following the Sunday page one story in the New York Times that the network and Bill O'Reilly himself have paid out more than $13 million in settlements to women who say he sexually harassed them. The Sunday Times story didn't necessarily tell us anything we didn't already know about the culture inside of Fox News, but it is kind of telling how big that number is.
Well, and the timing is important too. I mean, so first of all, what, $13 million plus he makes about $18 million a year. Still, that means over the past 3 years, Fox News, his show has generated for Fox News more than $300 million. So you see the dilemma in terms of whether or not they reprimand him, punish him, get rid of him. I mean, they're Fox News Channel and their parent company, 21st Century Fox, are liable now in ways they weren't liable before, because after Roger Ailes was booted out, they basically made statements about how they weren't going to allow this kind of thing to occur. And if they're continuing to protect somebody who's doing the same kind of stuff, they could be in much bigger liability than they were before.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that they're losing a lot of advertisers.
Yeah, we're coming up on like a dozen advertisers now.
I mean,
now that
pretty big ones.
Away.
I mean, you're talking about Mercedes-Benz, you're talking about Hyundai, you know, and One of the issues that's really going to magnify this is, are they going to start losing other talent? Because it just doesn't seem like this stops at Bill O'Reilly. I mean, there is a culture here of this kind of thing happening, and how do you manage that? I mean, they're in crisis management mode around sexual harassment 24/7 ever since Gretchen Carlson left.
And in fact, there is a story, I think we have a link to it in CNN Money, where they're talking about how inside the company, there are many women who are employed at Fox News Channel who are simply afraid to come forward, even though there's an anonymous hotline you can call, despite the assurances from the corporation that they're going to listen. They're just afraid they're going to be punished or at least have their careers damaged if they come forward.
And I understand that Bill O'Reilly's bringing in a lot of money. But ultimately, it's going to start costing you money. How long are the advertisers going to stay away? And the longer they stay away, the less money that's going to be coming in. And now it becomes a big liability to them. And they're going to have to figure out how do we get ourselves out of this situation.
And I think, Amy, one of the real liabilities for them is in a separate but related investigation. The federal investigators are looking into whether or not the parent company misled investors by not telling about these settlements with O'Reilly. Now, they've given immunity, apparently, or offered immunity to the former chief financial officer of the company. And if he testifies and it's bad, that could be much higher liability for the company than what they're facing at the moment.
What types of penalties might they be looking at?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, it's a civil suit, and
right.
So you know the damages could be extensive.
Okay, astronomical, really. Well, this next story is one that has a lot of interesting layers that the three of us had seen play out in who knows how many emails going back and forth among J-School faculty and staff during the course of the last week because of how concerning it is on so many levels. It has to do with the firing of a reporter from WUTC, the Chattanooga public radio station, owned and operated by the University of Tennessee. Here's what happened in a nutshell. Jackie Herbert accompanied students from Cleveland High School's newly formed Gay Straight Alliance to the state capitol to meet with their local lawmakers to express concerns over anti-LGBTQ legislation pending in the state. She carried equipment, by all accounts, a lot of equipment. She says she had a long shotgun microphone microphone with her. That's one of those on the long stick to be able to get access to somebody far away. She had on headphones and a digital recorder strung over her chest. She was carrying one of the station's logo tote bags with additional equipment and wore a lanyard with press credentials. Still, State Senator Mike Bell says he didn't know that he was being recorded in her presence and questioned her journalism. So he brought it up to one of his colleagues who reps the district where WUTC is, and he brought it up to the university's chancellor, since the university owns the public radio station. Today, Hilbert is unemployed, and there are groups rallying around her, including students on the UTC campus.
It was amazing, like, when I first decided to go to, like, you know, start talking to the press, I wasn't sure what the reception was going to be, but it's like, both sides, like today I did an interview with conservative talk radio, and like we may not agree on so many things, but they were like, you know, we believe in freedom of the press and we stand behind you. So it's been incredible that this is, you know, something that a lot of people can rally behind.
And there have been a lot of people rallying behind her, among them National Public Radio, NPR itself, issuing a statement questioning the role of the university administrators in making a firing over an editorial decision.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is one of those situations where you have a legislator who complains to a chancellor, and then there's overreaction on the part of administrators down the pipeline, and then she winds up losing her job, and the backlash isn't worth what you did. I mean, did she do anything wrong? I don't see where she did. She was there. She covered it. She probably didn't say, hey, I am a reporter, but everything else demonstrated that she was there, she was reporting it. And from the story itself that she reported, I don't see where there was any kind of leaning one way or the other in terms of what was actually going on. The students there trying to talk to their legislators about a bill pending that they felt was not in their best interest.
Now, WUTC has removed that story from its website. There is a cached version available on our links blog through the Wayback Machine, which is an Internet Archive website.
There's also a website called shameonutc.org, which has not only that information, but has surreptitiously recorded conversations that Hilbert made when she realized she was in trouble. And because Tennessee is a one-party consent state, unlike Missouri, she could legally do that. And so you can hear recordings of the station staff talking about how they're going to manage all of this. So it's really damning stuff now that she's filed a lawsuit. But I think what's, you know, there's some journalistic issues here that are really important to me. One, should she have identified herself as a reporter verbally if she was in a meeting that was quasi-private or whatever? Yeah, probably she should have. Would it have made any difference, though? I mean, I don't think so. I think the problem is that the legislators were upset with the story she actually produced. And that's when they started complaining about it. And they used this pretense or whatever. They used the fact that she did not identify herself openly as a reporter as their leverage. Then they allegedly threatened $50 million in support that the state government gives to the station and the university if they didn't fire her. So that's a problem. But I think the really big problem here is the relationship between universities as licensees of public radio stations and the independence that those stations need if they're going to do good journalism.
So let's talk about that for a second. Before we do, though, I do want to mention Missouri is a one-party state. So like Tennessee, it could have been recorded here. Only one party in the state of Missouri does need to be aware of that. I believe there are only five states in the nation that aren't. This is an issue, though, of the setup within the university and universities and schools owning public radio stations. Interestingly enough, it's a completely different setup than what we have here.
True, because at the University of Tennessee Chattanooga, the PR arm of the university managed or was a licensee for the station. At KBIA, for example, at the moment, at least, I mean, the university owns the license, but in a deal that our former dean made before he retired, he brought complete management control of the station, not just the news operation, under the School of Journalism, which provides a lot more protection for student journalists working here than at a lot of other university stations.
This brings up, and there's an interesting piece also on our links blog from the Columbia Journalism Review that's taking a look at all of this today, how editorial control is very much like the idea of academic freedom, and that the journalists working at these stations that are still perhaps controlled by the public relations or communications arms within universities do still need that same freedom to publish their journalistic content that their academic faculty are given in terms of their publication and academic freedom.
Right, right, absolutely. And they need to have that both from the academic standpoint, but also from the journalistic standpoint to be able to cover issues that are relevant to not only their listeners, but also various other constituencies. I mean, it's just like if you're in many ways from an editorial side, mm-hmm. the newspaper of the particular community or a commercial operated news operations has that same sort of ability to be able to do that. And what bothers me is the pressure that these legislators put on the station and on the licensee. These are state legislators. Those licenses are given to them by the federal government, not by the state government. So, you know, being able to put that kind of pressure on them from a financial standpoint, I just think is totally unfair and shouldn't have happened in that regard.
Unfair, but how do you also avoid that? On some levels, we see some of that ourselves even here in the state of Missouri, in the sense that the state legislature is still controlling the budget that goes to that state university.
Yeah, I mean, as long as a public radio station gets a huge amount of money from government, whether it's state or federal government, there's always going to be this problem. And even if you have policies in place that give, you know, freedom of expression to the radio station for its news coverage, bad things can happen. Remember right after 9/11, KOMU, not a public station, but one that the university licenses, got in trouble because the news director said you can't wear flag pins as sort of this ostentatious show of patriotism. And the legislature tried to get him fired, and the news director, and almost succeeded in doing it. They did succeed in taking money away from the university right. as punishment. So this can happen here, and it can happen in a lot of other places.
So a reporter writes or airs something that you don't like, you can claim you've been libeled, right? Well, no, not really. There's that whole best defense against libel is the truth. If it's true, it's not libel. And if it's the best truth you know at the time, the wronged party has to prove malice. We talked about that a bit last time that we were here and had the show, when we talked about the story coming out of San Luis Obispo, California. That's why it's interesting that President Trump is bringing up his plan again to change libel laws. I'm kind of trying to resist the urge to call this crazy talk. Let's talk about all the reasons why it can't happen.
No, he can't do it, because the only way that's going to happen is either the Supreme Court is going to have to change.
That there's going to have to be a constitutional amendment.
It has to be a constitutional mm-hmm. amendment, or the current Supreme Court is going to have to overrule a previous Supreme Court in Sullivan versus the New York Times, which also is very unlikely to happen. So I get where Trump has been doing this even before he became president, before he ran for president. He's always had this sort of relationship with the media where if you print anything that I feel is negative toward me, then I'm going to threaten to sue you. And now that he's president, he's getting these ideas that, okay, now I can really act on changing libel law.
No, I don't think so.
Theoretically, you know, if enough of the current Supreme Court justices who are old, retired, or died, he might be able to replace them with enough folks to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan. It seems highly unlikely. And as we've talked about on this show before, there's a really high bar
right.
for public figures to succeed in suing news media for libel. You have to show not only that you gave false information, but you knew it was false and you recklessly disregarded that right. fact that it was false, and the public figure has to suffer some kind of damage to their reputation, and I'm not sure the president at least could prove that.
Right. Okay, so it's a little bit like poking at a beehive with a stick, but to add another layer to this and really think about it, the Pew Research Center released a study yesterday. It was a two-question survey that went out that looked very specifically at how the public right now is looking at Trump's relationship with the media and how it's being perceived. And 83% of the 4,000 people that were surveyed have described the relationship between the media and President Trump as unhealthy. And 73% are saying that they think that unhealthy relationship is having a negative effect on their ability to get what they're calling real and important political news.
I'm not surprised by that, because one of the things that continues to happen, and I think people are starting to become aware of this, is that you, as long as you have this sort of adversarial relationship between the president and the media. The news that really has an impact on them in their daily lives is not getting through because all of this relationship becomes the news, and it's just not healthy. So these numbers don't surprise me at all.
They surprise me a little in a very positive way, and I hope that kind of concern is maintained, because journalists need that kind of support from the public if we're going to maintain and build the trust that we need right now.
No, I agree, but I think that what needs to happen is that journalists need to not pay so much attention to the relationship they have with the president and pay attention to what he's actually doing. And I think you're starting to see some of that, and that's where you're getting this backlash from Trump and others saying, well, you're creating a very hostile environment, and you're not presenting me in a favorable light. Therefore, I'm going to sue you or try to change libel law.
So part of this that's a little, I don't know, unnerving, I guess, or where I'm not sitting well with this was a two-question survey. So we have that there are the 83% that say it's an unhealthy relationship, the 73% that say that they don't think that they're getting access to important political news. What we don't get is who the public blames for the unhealthy relationship, or who's standing in the way. Is it Trump that they believe is standing in the way, or is it the media that they believe is standing in the way?
And given the partisanship and the divide we're in right now, my guess is it depends on
who it is. Yeah. That
who you're asking.
Yep.
And whether you know whether
that we don't know.
That we don't know.
Okay. Well, so here is something that did happen, and here is something that we do know. The Senate and the House have both voted to repeal Obama-era internet privacy laws, making it possible for internet service providers like AT&T and Verizon, Mediacom, you know, the whole lot, to sell your entire search history to anyone who wants to buy it. The idea is that it would provide advertisers with a wealth of data about what you're interested in, and where you bank, what you read, what you watch, what you buy, everything that you do online. There are a lot of arguments out there that Facebook and Google have been doing this for years, but with Facebook and Google, you are the product. You're getting it for free. Feels a little bit different when you're paying a service provider to give you that service, and then they're selling your information.
And it isn't just the huge players that are using this data to try to customize content for you either. I mean, frankly, we ought to talk at some point a little bit about the sort of double standard of news organizations, which desperately want that kind of access to data that Facebook and others have right now. They just don't want to have to get it through Facebook or iTunes or Google. They want to be able to control this data and customize news content. So we have a bit of a conflict of interest. Nonetheless, I would say this privacy issue and whether or not people should consent is an important one, even though we should specify those rules that the FCC under Obama passed weren't going into effect until the end of this year. We're not losing protections. We're just not gaining the ones we thought we were going
to
get.
Well, and to me, part of it is that the whole consent part, because you know, people will give up their consent without even knowing it.
Could be buried in a user agreement that you just click on.
That you just click on agree, and there you go. And there are tools on your mobile devices, on your computers, that allow you to block a lot of this that people just don't know about because they're not educated about the nuances of how these work. So they don't know that I can block it, but they see it pop up and they go like, well, wait a minute, how did they know that I bought this, or how did I buy that? And then they just start clicking on things, hoping that it'll go away, and it just doesn't happen.
It's interesting because I brought up this subject with my class earlier this week to see how outraged they might be about losing these potential privacy protections. Nothing. I mean, you can speculate as to why. My speculation might be that millennials generally just figure, my privacy's gone already. I'm not getting it back. It's the price you pay for being online.
Well, they may not have had it as digital natives. Right. They don't know what they had before to know or understand maybe why they wouldn't want all that out there. It's always been there their whole lives.
One of the real threats here could be, you know, having your identity stolen. Mm-hmm. And until that happens to you as an individual, you don't realize just how unprotected you are out there.
I have to say, though, I mean, we should say a little bit about the positives of sites that you visit frequently having access to some of your user data, because we've proven we want content targeted to us. I mean, for example, you know, you go to Amazon, you want them to have your data so they can recommend shows that you might not know about. You go to, you know, you go
iTunes.
You go into iTunes. Amazon recommends books or products or services. We all want targeted information until we don't, until somebody says, oh, well, it's violating my privacy.
Right.
So there is one way around this, the idea of using a VPN, a virtual private network. It's something, it's software the university provides us with so that we can get around firewalls, or if we're traveling abroad, have a domestic IP address again. These are also available for purchase, for subscription use, but would that even present a shield, or are you just kicking the can down the road and giving somebody else the opportunity to sell your data?
It's a bit of a shield, and that's people who sell VPNs are selling it to you or giving it to you on the basis of this is going to protect your privacy. And so if they were trying to sell your data, that would perhaps send you to another person that provides that service. I would use one anyway if I were somebody out there. Anytime I'm out in public where there's an insecure network that I'm connecting to, because maybe it's not your data that's being gathered up by companies, but there are hackers out there who are getting your stealing your identity.
Yeah.
Governments, if you're in a foreign country, could be monitoring your content because there's no protection. You should do this anyway, but I don't know that it's going to help that much with the problem that we're talking about right now.
Okay, well, there's an interesting piece published in the Columbia Journalism Review that I want to point your attention to. You can find it on our links blog at kbia.org. Carrie Myers used to be an inmate at the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola and was the editor of its award-winning prison newspaper, The Angolite. Well, now that he's out of prison, he's written a critique of how we cover the criminal justice system using his personal experience as a prisoner and a journalist. We have developed an obsession with the true crime genre thanks to podcasts like Serial and documentaries like The Jinx and Making a Murderer. But he raises some pretty valid points about how, on the whole, journalists aren't covering the criminal justice system well.
And we really have not ever covered the criminal justice system well, because we always cover it, or most of the time we cover it from the aspect of the officials, law enforcement, judges, attorneys, whether you're talking about prosecuting attorneys or those who are representing
defense
attorneys. And what happens is that if you're always covering it from that aspect, you aren't covering it either from the victim's point of view or from the criminal's point of view. And I think this is where this story becomes interesting, because he talks about the nuances of what happens if you're in the system, mm-hmm. and what can happen to you from that aspect, which we never get to. We never get to that. How is it adjudicated? How do you go through that process? What happens after a person goes into the prison system? How do we keep dealing with recidivism and that sort of thing? So that's what I find interesting about this.
Yeah, and there are exceptions, of course, good coverage of the criminal justice system, but too much of it, as he points out, is episodic.
Right.
We're just there for a quick hit because people are interested in crime from the perspective of law enforcement or mm-hmm. the bad actor.
Right.
My only concern about his piece in the Columbia Journalism Review is that I don't think he gave very many details for somebody who's lived a life where he has a lot of details. He cited one case, mm-hmm. which I thought was fascinating. He talked about the suicide of a court official and how the reporters said, well, yeah, he committed suicide. They never dug into why he did, and why he did it is because he was covering up for judges who basically said, automatically deny any appeal hearings for any of these inmates, and hundreds of them never even got a chance to make their case. That's why he said he killed himself. No reporters dug into that except maybe one local news organization, and that's the kind of digging we ought to do on all kinds of stories like this.
Okay, well, normally this clip that I'm about to play doesn't come out unless it's November, Thanksgiving time, but I'm going to ask you to humor me for just a minute.
Come on now, tell us the rest.
I really don't know how to describe it. It was like the turkeys mounted a counterattack. It was almost as if they were organized. As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
Okay, why that little 30-second interlude besides a cheap laugh? Because I know I laugh at it cheaply every time I see it. Well, that's because this is how WLS-TV in Chicago led its 10 o'clock newscast one night last week.
Hitting a deer can be extremely dangerous for drivers, but tonight, a graphic warning about what else can happen this time of year.
So just take a look. A family driving in Northwest Indiana hit a wild turkey. You can see just how much damage that can do. Tonight, the father who was in that car is talking exclusively to ABC 7 News. Rob Elgus is here with the story, Rob.
Yeah, Alan, driving about 50 miles per hour on US 20, John Tarabaccia says it looked like a tiny airplane coming right at him. Opening its wings too late, the turkey crushed his rental car windshield, his family stunned by what just happened.
And out of nowhere, this turkey starts flying. All I see the wings open up, coming right towards me.
Okay, we're talking about the number one station in the number three market on its newscast of record. That was the lead. The producer in me loves this story, but this is not a lead story.
I would have run the story. I mean, no question about it. I would have not led with the story. I would have run it. It's just too good a story to pass up as like a kicker for the end of the newscast.
It's a kicker. It's not the lead.
It isn't the lead. And then it was really hilarious because after they got some criticism for it, they tried to justify it by running a story a couple of days later saying, another attack has occurred in southern Indiana. A trooper's car was hit by a turkey and nothing bad happened there either, except to the turkey. You know, the problem for this for me is they tried to make it sound like it was a real emergency. Oh, it's mating season for turkeys. Be careful when you're out on the roadways. And they just got caught doing what, unfortunately, too many television news producers are doing these days, and that's saying, well, we're competing against YouTube and the Facebook videos, all this viral stuff that's out there.
The latest cat video.
We're going to run this turkey thing, and it's just not going to produce the results they hope it's going to produce.
I can't stop laughing.
Maybe it was better that I accidentally forgot to send you the script before the show.
But the problem is you're watching the clip and it's a straight face. I mean, they're straight face telling the story and I'm going like, how can you do that?
It's almost like WKRP with Les Nessman saying, oh, the humanity.
It's just, I don't get it.
The part that really concerns me is that we have, and Mike, you were starting to talk about this, we have this serious problem of audiences starting to walk away from television news because they're not feeling as though they're being informed by it. They feel like they're being talked down to or that they're being provided with, for lack of a better term, like news for the stupid. Like, it's going to be raining, turn on your windshield wipers and your headlights and slow down. Not things they can really feel informed by or can drive their day or become more knowledgeable.
No, I agree with you completely. I think the bigger problem is that the way we make money in local television news is that we have to constantly tease you along throughout a newscast that's very formulaic, as you say, in the kinds of information we provide. If we got to the point, and I've been arguing this for many years, if news organizations start saying, we're going to make our money off of the quality of the individual reports we do and how relevant they are to your lives, then maybe we break down that newscast model and we don't slip into something like this.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no reason for this to be the lead story. I just don't get it.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Our original theme music is composed by Tim Pilcher. Lauren Wortman is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.